Hey everybody, it's your buddy Luke, and we got a little listener love to start off this episode of the Dirtbag State of Mind podcast, and this is from Brooklyn Hayes from Omaha, Nebraska.
Hey Luke, I just finished the first season of Dirtbag State of Mind. I just had to let you know that your storytelling is captivating and you are so totally inspiring. Keep rocking on, and thank you for fighting the good fight and staying here so you can share your story. I've been thinking for a long time about what's next for me and who I want to be, and you've lit a fire under my ass to pursue what I'm passionate about and really start fully living. Thank you so much for who you are and everything you do for the rock climbing community.
Welcome to the Dirtbag State of Mind podcast from the Climbing Zine. I am Luke Mihal, and this is episode 1 of season 6, a conversation with my friend Felipe Garcia. I'm super excited to be back with another season of the podcast. We always take a little break in between seasons, and the season structure works really well for us to kind of reset. Obviously, the Dirtbag State of Mind podcast is not the only thing that I create. The Climbing Zine is kind of the bread and butter of my life's work. I'm also working on a book, and I got a mixtape coming out. But as I said in our preseason episode with our producer, Chad Rich, sitting down and having these conversations is really like the favorite part of my job. There's preparation, there's a bit of nerves sometimes, but once I really sit into the conversation, it's amazing how an hour-long conversation will just evolve into something, and you really don't know where it's exactly going to go. And this conversation is super interesting with Felipe, and we go all over the world, to Guatemala, where he's from, to crags in Mexico, like El Potrero Chico, and life at sea. Felipe goes to sea for 2 months at a time and trains while he's there. We also have our storytelling episodes. And if you look at the first couple seasons of the podcast, those are me reading a book. So I originally started off as book on tape, and we really evolved into a hybrid of that format and then really good conversations for about an hour or so. With this new season, we are stepping up our efforts for the Keep the Zine Alive campaign, and our Patreon is really a big component of that. And Chad and I have been talking a lot about how we can start to deliver more goodies for our Patreon supporters. We're at $166 a month right now, and we'd like to get that to $2,000 by the end of 2024. So by the end of this season, we'd like to reach that benchmark. You can join that for as little as $3. We've got perks of stickers, and as things go up, you can get zines, you can get books, you can get Dirtbag State of Mind merch. So check that out. That's the link in our bio on our Instagram page, and you can also find that link in the show notes. This episode is brought to you by Onyx Backcountry, the ultimate all-in-one adventure mapping and navigation app. Imagine this. Friday is here. It's time to hit the road for that climbing trip you've been dreaming about all week. Fire up Onyx Backcountry. Turn on the government and private land map layers to quickly find a dispersed camp area. Then switch on the 3D map to find an epic spot with views. Finally, turn on the all-new climb mode, which pairs mountain project route and area beta with the best in-class navigation tools Onyx is known for to find your next climb. From there, switch over to hike, mountain bike, or snow mode for nearby trails and guidebook content to inspire multi-activity days. Drop some waypoints to remember where to fill up on water and download an offline map for getting off the grid. The combination of multi-activity local expert and guidebook content, mountain project beta, and high-res maps and navigation tools makes for the all-in-one app we've been waiting for. Subscribe now using promo code ZINE20 for 20% off your Onyx Backcountry subscription and redefine your backcountry adventures. This episode is sponsored by Kilter. Looking for a fun way to train at home or at the gym? Check out the Kilter Board. The Kilter Board has innovative light-up holds, a progressive app, and animated functions with climbs for all abilities, and two layouts to choose from with large online communities for each. There are over 100,000 problems in the original Kilter board layout, and the newer home board layout comes with over 10,000 problems. You can set, tick climbs, make shareable playlists, watch send videos for motivation and beta, and even add your own videos to share with other users. Kilter has multiple wall sizes and package options available, so we can help get you a Kilter board in almost any space. Check out Kilter at settercloset.com and look for more information in our show notes. This episode of the Dirtbag State of Mind podcast is brought to you by Osprey. Tired of your old tattered climbing pack? It's time you met the Zealot from Osprey. Osprey was born at the foot of the Sierras and came of age in the ranges, deserts, and canyons around Cortez, Colorado. When it comes to climbing, their Zealot series is purpose-built and athlete-tested, with ballistic nylon to defy years of dirtbagging. Their Zealot 40 is a proper rope-hauling crag bag made with the same attention to detail and carrying comfort that Osprey is known for. And their Zealot 30 is dialed in for the days that take you from work to the gym, using dual compartments to keep your everyday carry and climbing gear separate. Make sure your gear isn't the crux of the day. The Zealot is available online at osprey.com or at your local retailer. This episode is also sponsored by Scarpa. Scarpa's approach to climbing shoe design mirrors their approach to the pursuit of climbing itself. They strive to evolve and incorporate new ideas and techniques every step of the way. They refine their strengths, train their weaknesses, and build on each success. Scarpa has been bolstering its climbing shoe foundations by continuing to create versatile, high-quality designs that satisfy the needs of climbers across a range of disciplines and skill levels. For more information, check out scarpa.com or head to our show notes. All right, I'm excited to share this conversation with my good friend, Felipe Garcia. Hope you all enjoy. Disfruta. I'm chilling here with Felipe Garcia, my good friend, and we're in the El Potrero Chico Outdoor Dirtbag State of Mind studio. Welcome, Felipe.
Hi. Happy to be here.
We're relatively new friends. We just started climbing together in October. I met you here in El Potrero Chico, and then I think within 24 hours, we were like putting up a new route together because we realized we were both new route junkies.
And sorting out an accident shortly after.
And had an accident too. Yeah, which we can get into. And that was kind of like the impetus of wanting to chat with you is, first of all, just to record a bit of this season. I mean, this season has just been intense. There's so much that has happened. So I want to have one audio memory of it. We've seen the highs and highs and the lows of lows. Like, we've both sent our hardest sport route this season. Yeah. And then, you know, we've both either been involved in accidents or had a friend pass away.
Yeah.
And that's the ultimate lows, you know, of climbing. I laughed as a coping mechanism. You know, it's like, it's been intense, but I don't want to get too intense right off the bat. I think you've become a great friend. I think we have very similar interests, and the more time goes by in climbing for me, I realize the more unique I am and like what I'm seeking out. And so to find a partner that wants to seek out the same things, it's been really cool.
Yeah. Same for me. It's really cool to connect with someone that's willing to go out there, climb, but also like share stories and just hang out. So that's really cool.
And so where are you from in Guatemala?
I was born and raised in the capital city.
The capital city.
Yeah. Whenever I say that, like I also make a note saying like the worst type of person, because in the same way that people from Mexico City are not loved, people from Guatemala City are not loved in the rest of the country.
So, interesting. Yeah. Okay. All right. I love watching you climb, and you're just a real natural, really strong climber. And you said that took eons to cultivate. So how did you discover climbing in Guatemala, and where were like the seedlings of Felipe climbing?
Yeah, it was backpacking through Mexico, actually, with a friend of mine. We're at this hostel and we meet two girls from Sweden. Like in the conversation, they just randomly said that they like climbing. And I'd always seen it as something on TV, or like in my mind, you had to be an Olympic athlete to climb. And like, it was not something accessible to the everyday person. And they're like, yeah, we climb with our parents and our grandparents. And my friend is like, yeah, there's a climbing gym in Guatemala. I had no idea. So yeah, when we got back from the trip, I went to a climbing gym and I really struggled, but I loved the challenge. So yeah, that's the very beginning of it.
Wow. And so how do you transfer from being in the gym to outdoor climbing? Because the way you were describing you getting into outdoor climbing, it sounded like the romantic way that people in the U.S. got into climbing in like the 60s and the 70s. Huh.
Except that there were bolts, because there had been a generation previous to my generation that had developed and bolted and climbed some lines and had their projects and gone up through the grades. But they had moved on by the stage I started climbing. So it was really cool going to these crags and not really knowing grades, numbers, names, nothing. It was like really cool to discover in my own way, like doing my own interpretation of it, just working my way up the grades. I mean, eventually I did get to know all of the myth and the legends of a climbing scene there. But it was really cool to work my way up, not knowing grades or anything. But yeah, it was just two friends that just talked me into going rock climbing. And I remember the first thing where they were saying, it's not like the gym. Like, you have to just pace yourself and take it really slow. And like, the point is not to fall. So yeah, it's not like today where like the point is like, oh yeah, you can do fall practice, right? Yeah, interesting.
Before I met you, I hadn't even been aware of climbing in Guatemala. And the way you describe the areas and some of your experiences just sounds so fascinating and so unique. And so, like, kind of describe what, you know, a special Guatemalan crag is kind of like in the sense of the people praying and the multi-users, I guess, of the areas.
I'll try to do it justice because I'm sure it really depends who you ask. You're going to get a different answer.
Yeah, Felipe did a presentation at our zine thing at La Posada the other night, and it's so colorful, everything there.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the virtues of the country is that it's really colorful. Lots of the indigenous people have like really colorful outfits, and it's remarkable. I don't really get that sense out of any other country how colorful it can be. So yeah, that's really cool. So anyways, there's two main crags that have been developed for like over like 20 years. One is called Amatitlan. That's in a volcano caldera, actually. So it's like a conglomerate of volcanoes that blew up like a long time ago. And you're climbing on this rim of an ancient caldera. You know, you have volcanoes and you have like a magma at the crust, and the lava flowing up, like the tip of the iceberg, is not really representative of how big the whole thing really is. So imagine the caldera being like a huge volume of lava and magma just like in the earth, and the volcano being just the tip of the iceberg.
What's the texture of that like?
It looks a lot like limestone.
Okay.
Yeah, but it's volcanic of origin.
Is it like hard like rock?
Yeah. Okay. Oh yeah, it's okay. Rock. Okay. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. But it's really cool because it's a volcanic rim through the like centuries, whatever. It now turned into a lake. Mm-hmm. So that's really cool. And then there's this other crag called Quetzaltenango, Xela, that is more of a slow eruption. I don't know the specifics. I'm not a volcano expert, but the lava is quite dense. So an eruption looks like shards sticking out of the ground, which looks like the apocalypse. So it attracts a lot of religious people and a lot of religious beliefs around this whole place. We have to share the place with a bunch of people that go there for many different reasons. You get people doing that want to climb the volcano legitimately just to bag that peak. As rock climbers, like, there are some amazing walls. Like, imagine like a magma, I don't know, like this massive volume of magma that just, as it was getting cooler, it just like broke up, and you have these splitter cracks. Honestly, if you bring a trad rack down there, you're going to have fun. And you have like all these religious groups, yeah, like pilgrims that go do their thing.
And is this near the area where you said there was a volcano that they thought was going to cover the city?
Yeah, that is the volcano.
That is. And yeah. So the people are worshiping the fact that the volcano erupted but stopped short of a certain
Correct.
Area.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh. So they're like, oh, so therefore, if we were praying and the volcanic eruption stopped right at the edge of the town, then it works, like praying works. So then it just attracted a ton of pilgrims.
The power of prayer.
Yeah. I'm not sure if that's even fact. Like, that could be mythology, but sure. you go to the town and you start seeing the eruption and the destruction of the volcano, like right at the edge. It's really
people
interesting.
People are still praying there for
oh, yeah.
that sense.
Yeah. Yeah. And praying looks very different to different people. You can have these like flower offerings. It looks like a very like Cosmo vision of the Mayan original vision of being like spiritual. So very introspective, very like a lot quieter than some other people that are just like trying to cause mass hysteria. And it's really interesting to climb in that place and you're like in the mix. So you can hear like people just like hysterically screaming and other people just praying really slowly. And it looks like meditation in a way. and you're trying not to look too closely because, of course, you want to keep the peace. And you're climbing in these like galleries of volcanic walls. It's yeah, it's really cool.
So what do they think of climbers?
Oh,
do you have good interactions with them?
For the most part. Uh-huh. I don't like the fact when someone approaches me and starts like trying to convince me of a god I don't really believe in. Mm-hmm. And I've had a few interactions where I tell like the person, like, you really want an answer? You want a straight answer? Like, yeah. And it leads to a bit of an awkward conversation. But the questions you get asked as a climber, like, oh, why don't you wear gloves? Like, what's that white powder? Is it flour? Like, what are you doing? Do you know there's a better way to access the top of the mountain? Like, are we harvesting gold? Like, they think we're mining for gold. Whoa. Yeah. Wow. Yeah, and they take pictures of you. Like, you appear to be an astronaut to them. Because also you don't look like most of the people doing the pilgrimage. Mm-hmm. So like by default, you're a gringo, even though like I was born and raised in Guatemala. Mm-hmm. By default, I'm a gringo.
It's connected all the way back to Mayan culture?
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Wow.
And it's been blended with Christianity. So it's this like really weird mix. And the fact that there's lots of garbage as well. So you get like shitty diapers and you get like these flower offerings and you get people like looking at the screens on iPhones and people just praying. And yeah, so it's quite an experience.
It's so cool to hear this from you in more detail because you've told me about this stuff in person. And then I feel like that's the beauty of a podcast is like you can have an hour long conversation and really dig into things more than you would if we were just sitting around
right
at Posada. You
yeah,
know,
exactly.
Eventually we're just gonna be playing cards and spraying yeah. about climbing, you know.
Yeah.
And we're spraying about climbing right now, but it's super fascinating to me to hear about climbing in Guatemala. It like makes me want to go there and visit you.
Yeah, yeah.
And so how do you journey becoming a documentarian? Because you said you've written one guidebook?
Yeah.
Yeah, one guidebook, and you might write another, you might do another edition.
I'd like to update the one for Amatitlan and yeah, eventually start compiling the climbs for Quetzaltenango.
Amazing. How did you turn it? Because I'm not a guidebook author, but I like to document as well. I think that's another thing we have in common. It's like I really find it fascinating. And I actually applaud guidebook authors. Guidebook authors get no love. You're a guidebook author, so you can tell me how your interactions are with people. But I know in the United States, like any mistake you make, you're just going to be crucified by shit talking and stuff. So I feel like guidebook authors could do a big labor of love. How do you start documenting things in Guatemala? And like, where does that urge come from for you?
Just out of curiosity and out of the fact that it's so permanent. Like the rock has been there for such a long time and we're calling it names and putting bolts in, but it's been there for such a long time. So that's like the sense of time and the perspective of that has really fascinated me. So I interviewed the OGs of developing, placing bolts, because even before that generation, there were some climbers that were just going up some crack systems with like wooden wedges.
Wooden wedges.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
Yeah. Actually, priests in Quetzaltenango, they were like, well, the mythology goes that they were like priests going up to the summit with wooden wedges to use as like steps.
That
no
is
ropes.
The coolest thing I've ever heard. Wow. That is fascinating, Felipe. Okay. Okay. So it goes back super, super old school.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
In Mexico, as was talked about, the Sueños de Altura, they're like using the most basic, almost like nails as gear. And wow, that's fascinating. So wooden wedges in the cracks.
To use as handholds and footholds.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So no ropes.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. And have you come across these wooden wedges?
No.
No.
No. They're long gone. There's the odd piton in a crack. Yeah. I interviewed some of the original guys, like the developers. And it was really interesting to get their perspective. You can see the progression of like how you start attacking a blank wall via the weakest line and slowly you start adding. So that was really cool. And then like compiling all the information with my good friend Fabian.
You told me it took you a while to take the journey to find these guys.
Yeah.
Was there ever any sense of trad climbing versus sport climbing?
Or not at all.
Like that? No.
Not at all.
Not at all.
It's just like anything goes.
I think that's so interesting because in the United States, there's such an ethic. Like there's like people will go to war over a bowl, you know? And then you go south of United States, like Mexico is if you didn't have bolts here, you wouldn't have climbing, you know?
Yes.
Or you would, but it wouldn't be like it is. There's no real like development of a trad ethic or anything. It's just
I think it's infant stage.
Yeah.
Like you do get the, like some of the old school guys, like they were really into like, no, respect the rock. And if there is a way to protect it with a piece, yeah, like please do.
That's how I feel like I started. It was the bolts are there, but if you ever can use a piece of gear.
Yeah. Yeah. But then like most of the climbers don't really have access to gear. So just out of necessity, like if you want to go up a climb and you don't want to deck, like you're just going to place a bolt. I think looking back, it would make more sense to have more mixed lines or some like dedicated trad lines. A lot of it has bolts. There are still some really pure lines that don't have any bolts. And I think just by looking at the aesthetics of those lines, like even if you have a drill in hand, like you're not going to, it would be sacrilege.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, you're kind of documenting in, what are you thinking as you're about these original climbers? Like, do you hear rumors about who they are? Is there like one or two names that keep popping up, like the prolific people? Like, what does that look like?
Yeah, there's a lot of mythology with Guatemala, not only within the climbing community.
And there's no guidebook at this point.
Correct. Yeah. No guidebook. I do remember this one funny story where the, like one of the first guys that climbed 10D when 10D was like, holy shit, like you're a 10D climber. That was like one of his big claims to fame.
Shout out to the 10D boys. Yeah. If you're listening. Oh, you know who you are. What was their name? They were the 10D. They weren't going to be the boys. They didn't want to be like the white
Will
boys.
And Callum.
Will and Callum. But what was their, shout out to Will and Callum from the UK, Young G's. What was their name? Because they didn't want to be the boys. They didn't want to be biting the white boys.
They were like
much.
The boys with a C.
The 10D.
Boys.
Boys. Like. Boys. That's right. 10D boys.
So yeah, anyways, the story goes that the guy is like approaching us, like newer climbers, like young punks, like, oh, do you even know who this, like, do you know the name of this climber? And that, like, that was him, like trying to like research if like we knew our mythology and our heroes correctly, because he was trying to ask if we knew his name.
Interesting. Yeah. Interesting. Like he was kind of flexing or
yeah,
what?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. That's great. And so what are you thinking in your mind? Like, do you admire these people? Or are there certain people that you're like, this guy's the man or this girl? Was there any late, like female root developers?
No
or?
Females.
Okay.
No
male. Gotcha.
There are some like, yeah, young crushers now, mm-hmm. but there were no female developers. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And yeah. So what were your interpretations of these people? And then like what leads up to meeting them?
Oh, they were absolute heroes. Yeah. Like, yeah, like you could see him climb a 10D and it was like mastery. It's just like floating up the wall. And it was really cool because we were like more of the raw strength and pull really hard. You could tell that these guys had been climbing on rock for a very long time. So that was really cool. Total respect for those guys.
What does it look like when you get to meet them? Did you decide you're going to write a guidebook or how did you decide to do that?
It was pretty straightforward. I just started like asking them and they were like really supportive and like, yeah, they're all in favor of trying to compile all this information because I guess with age comes a lot of perspective as well. And it's your legacy in a way. So they're happy to share the information.
That's so well put because I don't think there's big guidebook debates anymore because people have other shit to argue about on the internet.
Exactly.
But I remember when guidebooks would come out, people were like, oh, should there be a guidebook and this and that? And I actually was at the center of one of those in the creek. Oh. With the cave wall, that wall I've probably sprayed you down about.
Yeah.
I mean, we put like 100 roots up in this area. And we're all like, you know, we want to keep it pristine and this and that. And then the guidebook author, Carl Kelly, actually talked us out of it. More of us were supportive of getting it in there, but some of us weren't. And it was like 5 years went by and we were like, we're so happy we put it in there because we don't even go to this wall anymore because life goes on. And like, that's cool that you had that experience because I do think, yeah, as age goes by, it's like, you're going to forget the details. Like I wrote, it was the Creek book was cool because I was able to write everything right away after we did it.
Mm-hmm.
And not all the roots are in the Creek book. There's a lot more, but it is pretty cool to document things, especially when it's correct because 20, 30 years go by and then you can't even remember what happened.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. And so, and you said this kind of all happened because of a climbing gym.
Yes. Yeah. And one of the owners was a guy that lived in Monterey for a while. So he was the one that talked me into going to Potrero. So I came to Potrero like 20 years ago.
What was your first year in Potrero?
I don't remember the year specifically, maybe 2005?
Dude, that was my first year here.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Wow. Crazy, dude. Yeah. Back in Homero. Yeah, Homero's was popping back in the day.
Homero, yeah, the parties.
All right, so
there.
I want to hear about this. So So what's the name of this gym?
Gravedad Cero. No longer a running business.
Okay, but yeah, you had it.
It's in the mythology now.
It's in the mythology, and it led you to these OG climbers. And,
yeah.
And so who's the gentleman that encouraged you to come to Potrero?
Kini, shout out. Americo's friend.
Americo knows him.
Yeah.
Interesting. Americo. Yeah. Talk about OGs.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I guess describe this time period of you get to start to get this information from the OGs, you're meeting them, and you're compiling the book, and then you're also coming to Potrero. What was your impressions of Potrero?
I loved it. Yeah. I thought it was really cool. Back then it was more of a, okay, we're going to try hard, but we're also going to party hard. I feel like today is more like I'm going to try hard and I'm going to do my self-care routine.
Oh, no, us. But I feel like we are surrounded, and I think that's why I gravitated to you, is because we're surrounded by people that are half our age. I feel like that party thing is still alive and well, but yeah, we're both like, all right, we're going to dip out and do our self-care. And I think we're in the lower numbers of people here, like people that are hovering. Yeah. Yeah, I know you're not 40 yet, but I feel like you're in the realm of
I'm
that.
I'm up there.
Yeah.
I do like a good sober karaoke. I'm
just
still,
sober karaoke.
Yeah, yeah,
okay.
Yeah. My stage name is Brittany Garcia.
Brittany Garcia. Wow. You sing Britney Spears stuff?
Yeah.
Wow, we got to get you and Mark Grundin into. Mark Grundin has one loud song he does that he sang at his wedding. I forget what it's called. But yeah, I do want to go back to Guatemala too, because I want you to just, give me a sense of what it's like there now. And where is the climbing community right now in Guatemala? And like, what's your finger on the pulse of like, are you, is it exciting? Like,
oh yeah.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. It has exploded out of proportions. Mm-hmm. I guess like in the same way that it did in the States, mm-hmm. like young crushers, like you wouldn't believe, like super strong, up and coming, like super motivated, just take them biggest whips, like, yeah, in the sun, don't give a shit.
Climb. We noticed that the younger that you are, the more you'll climb in the sun.
Yeah.
Like, it cherish those years.
Yeah.
You 20-somethings, yeah.
Yeah.
Or teenagers.
Yeah but it's
climbing in the sun.
It has blown up. I went to this gym opening recently, and it was crazy. Like, because normally it's such a small community, you know everybody. But I went there, and I was like, oh, holy shit. Like, I don't know anyone.
Oh, how is that feeling?
It's humbling for sure.
Uh-huh. I have that same feeling in Durango in a bit. Like, yeah. I'll go to our climbing gym, and Durango's a small town, but it's so crazy that happens in climbing. It's like one minute you just like, it's a small community, you know everybody, and then it's I mean, climbing is obviously in a growth stage right now too, you know?
Yeah.
That's cool to hear though. Like, and I feel like, I don't know, there's a certain excitement that I get more in like the Latino countries than I do in the United States. I feel like, I don't know, like, I feel like we're so... I don't want to say coddle in the sense of gym climbers, but like, it's just more exciting, I feel like, in Mexico and
the cheering.
Maybe in Guatemala. I don't know, just the general enthusiasm for climbing.
Yeah.
It feels, to me, it feels different here. I don't know.
Fine. It really gives you a sense of purpose. And yeah, it gave my life a lot of meaning. It still gives my life a lot of meaning. And it's really cool that it inspires younger generations and just, yeah, it's evolving. And yeah, you can't really steer it, but it, yeah. Like, now there's like this big push for bouldering. Like, that's the new big thing. But I think it comes around in circles. I think then they're going to move on to El Potrero, for example, like trying big walls and trad. And yeah, I think it like fashion, you know, mm-hmm. how it comes and goes. I think it's going to be like that.
Yeah, I feel like what's interesting about climbing is the fact that everything is alive now and still climbing. It always cracks me up when I hear some OG climber on a podcast like, oh, and climbing's bullshit now because of Instagram and people are doing this and this and being crusty, you know? And it's like, you know, we met this guy, Tim Greenwood, Tim G, he's in my phone, but he was just always the guy
Respect.
Not wearing a shirt at Posada and like humble young crusher.
Humble crusher.
But I look at a guy like him and his crew, Micah from Durango. I don't know what Micah's last name is. But I had a good time with these Durango guys, and they're literally like 24 and climbing shit that we're still working up to at, you know, I'm 45, you're what, 37?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I feel like that, and they're like, they have this trad ethic and this adventure ethic, and they're climbing, you know, Sendero Luminoso in no time at all and flashing every pitch. And then they're like up on El Cap, freeing stuff on El Cap. And it's like, the trad adventure ethic is still so alive. And then there is all these other things in climbing. It's amazing where, I guess just younger climbers, like, where they're
and
at right now.
They're also willing to give up their time to rebolt, like, a mega line.
Tim rebolted the line, I heard, because I've been rebolting in Montreal for the last two seasons, and I get a lot of feedback in the route, Time for Living, Kurt Smith route, shout out to the OG. So much feedback, like, people are like, rebolt Time for Living. I'm not really, like, a multi-pitch guy anymore, so I never got around to it, but Tim went up and did it. And he had a help from one of the guys from Escalada Libre, too. Shout out to that group out of Monterrey. Within the young climbers, every style is alive with them now.
Yeah.
And they're so much, like, better than we are. Like, it's pretty humbling.
Like,
I remember this day, you know, we were talking about, we both sent our hardest route, Cyclops, our first 13A for both of us, the session before I sent it. Micah onsighted it. Tim did it second try, and then this 14-year-old almost onsighted it.
Jesus.
Amazing. For me, it was a very truth moment with climbing. It's like, all right, why do I climb? Like, this is my hardest grade, but am I grade chasing? And it's like, no, I'm chasing the climb. And it's like, it's inspiring to see your ass get handed to you, because it's like, it's good to be humbled in climbing. And it was like, I don't know, I had the hardest send of my life mixed with just one of the humblest moments of, you know, the 14-year-old almost onside of your project. Like, you have to be stoked about that too.
Yeah.
You know? Because they're better than we are, and it's so cool.
But yeah, it's still meaningful to us all. That's really powerful too.
I think this is a good transition into talking about life on the boat, because I think you are one of the most psyched climbers I know. Like, I love you as a partner, because you're always going to be on 100. And I haven't known you that long, so I don't like know all that facets of your personality. Maybe if you could climb all the time, you would be that stoked. But it seems like you're condensing your climbing into 2-month periods, basically. And then you're working for a couple months, right?
2 months.
Tell us a little bit about your career. And it sounds like a wild career. And obviously, I want to get into training stuff. This is going to be the one podcast I actually talk about training. I never have, but I do train. I have started training, and you train as well, and we both love it. But I have a bad habit of asking like 3 questions in one. But let's just start with life on the boat and what kind of work that looks like. And
I work on boats. I am a marine engineer. I've been doing it for 10 years, and like now I'm at the stage where I work time for time. So that looks something like I'm working for 2 months every day. Every day is about a 12-hour day. And then I'm free for 2 months. The highs are really high and the lows are very low. Because, imagine like being committed for 2 months every day, 12 hours at least. And it's physical. Every day.
Wow.
You look at your normal clothes like, oh, shit, I wish I could wear this T-shirt right now. Cause, like, you're wearing a uniform every day.
Wow.
With the same group of people every day, like, there's no escape. So you have to do lots of sacrifices, like your privacy. There's no privacy. Yeah. So you have to find some way to stay sane. And for some people, that's like partying or trying to just like do retail therapy or training and being very disciplined. That's the way I stay sane. But yeah, like then the boat goes all over the place. It goes like right now it's in Australia. We did this almost 40-day crossing from Croatia through the Suez Canal all the way to Australia. And with all the conflict with Israel, like there was a boat in front of us, like 4 hours ahead of us, that got bombed. Imagine that. Like, holy shit, that was crazy. It's a different world. Like, you don't really notice, but like everything you use, like everything you have has been on a boat, has been crossing an ocean at some stage, either as a raw material or as a finished product. And like the ocean is a vast, vast place. It's a big mystery, and it's beautiful sometimes. But sometimes, like you're stuck in the engine room for days and days.
When I talk about your stoke, do you think that your structured time period increases your excitement for climbing, or do you think you're always that excited to climb?
I think I'm always that excited. I wish I could have more time to climb.
Wow.
Yeah. Like every time I come to Potrero, I'm like, okay, I'm going to stay here for another month, like an extra. Mm-hmm. I would like to spend more time climbing. But it definitely helps me structure my, like, okay, I'm going to be dedicating this time to just being disciplined and doing the hangboard, because as soon as I step off the boat, I want to be ready to climb some rocks.
Yeah, I'm trying to capture your stoke in a podcast, which I don't know how easy that is to do, but I legitimately feel like I love climbing a lot, and it's like Felipe loves climbing more than me. Like he's got the enthusiasm, and that's what you want out of a partner too. I think that's why you make a good partner, is I just can always rely on good energy for you, which especially this season with all the crazy shit that's happened, it's nice to have one partner you can really rely on. This season's been so interesting for us because like I met you one of the first days I was here, and then I met Ivan and Beto, which yeah. I refer to these guys as like the real Mexican dirtbags or whatever. These guys are living at Posada and living hand to mouth. But it's amazing that we met at the beginning of this season. I was down here early. You were down here early. And Potrero has a way that you come back. Like so many people I've seen right now have come back to Potrero. And it's like the cyclical thing. And you see the romances where people come back together and but Potrero has this way to like that has really brought us back, especially this season. And we're like finishing up this season. But I do want to go back to the boat before I dive back into Potrero. So your hangboard is like the tiniest hangboard I've ever seen.
But it's functional. Yeah.
And what's the name
small.
Of this hangboard?
It's made in Australia. It's called Awesome Woodies.
Awesome Woodies. All right. If you Awesome Woodies people are listening to this in Australia, please give us a shout. But this is literally the smallest. It looks like the board you bring to the crag to warm up in a small version of it.
Yeah.
And yet you've figured out a way to completely train on this thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I hang it on my little cabin and I just do my thing on the door frame. And yeah, I'm an engineer, so I do nerd out on all the protocols and all of the science and all the latest research and like, yeah, all those like climbing training podcasts for sure. But yeah, like that's it. But it like once I step off the boat, I have to adjust to wearing climbing shoes and technique and like fear of falling and all that. So you have to go through the learning curve all over again, which is cool. But at least like the strength is there. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that really helps. And I almost do it to stay sane because lots of people like drink on the boat or like they have like unhealthy relationships with sugar or like. Yeah, so it's not just really to stay strong. It's it's just to stay sane.
I can't completely relate to that because I've just never lived on a boat. But I really like hangboarding. Like some people are like, oh, it's so no one hangboards because it's boring and it sucks. It's like it took me a while. Like my coach is at my friend Adam Farrow, and he just set me up with he's like just do repeaters to start, you know, and warm up. But I really like hangboarding. It's like it's fun. You know,
yeah.
It's like I'm a workout person too. But yeah, there is also a mental component, I feel like, of hangboarding where like some other forms of exercise or even climbing, there's a weird focus to hangboarding.
Yeah, it's kind of meditative.
It is.
And music really helps.
Dude, music really helps. Yeah. What kind of music do you listen to?
I don't discriminate music. Everything, even from like romantic bachatas to salsa.
While you're working out.
Yeah.
Oh, see, I'm just straight up gangster rap. Like I can work out to nothing but gangster rap, like that type of stuff and weights.
Yeah.
It's not gangster rap, but like high paced rap.
Yeah. Man,
that's funny. So you're like listening to Carol.
I do love to dance and I think
you are
a
great
parallel.
Dancer. You're a man of many talents. But so when you're working out, any kind of music. Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Anything.
Interesting. And you mentioned to me in the past that you dabbled in intermittent fasting to kind of control the urges on the boat. To me, it seems to work really well for you. You always seem to be energized, and I'm sure you go in periods of doing intermittent fasting. But how'd you get into that, and like what benefits do you see with intermittent fasting?
Through one of the climbers in Guatemala. He's like a super dedicated climber. Like he's trying to get like any edge. Like he's into like barefoot running and like fasting and like what's that thing called when you like dive I forget the name, like when you're like diving, trying to dive without any oxygen, any tanks, or free diving. He's really into all of those like health hacks, if you will. So I learned it through him, and it seemed so counterintuitive because like what do you mean like to not be hungry, I have to not eat? Like it seems so counterintuitive, but it really helps me. I'm not the type of guy that's going to eat just like one little square of the chocolate bar. And yeah, like just also on the boat, I feel like you have like the access to sugar is unlimited. I actually think it's one of the strategies for boats to keep you hooked is just like providing booze and providing sugar, even though they tell you like, okay, we're going to slap you in the hand if you eat too much and you don't look pretty enough and you drink too much booze. Like, but like that, they keep you hooked because it never ends. Like there's an infinite supply. It's not like, oh, I'm just going to eat this like little chocolate bar and then like, that's it. Like you're not going to, no, like it gets restocked every day. Yeah. I think it's one strategy that works for me to just be disciplined.
Yeah, I want to move into talking about Potrero, and this, like, as I alluded to at the beginning of this podcast, has been a crazy season. It's been fucking crazy, and like, I don't even know how to try to sum it up, but I will just say that there have been accidents, there's been near misses, there's been a fatality of our friend Matt Richard. But at a really basic level, I just want to talk about, like, dude, you had this thing. I was literally telling you the story about how my helmet saved my life here last year.
Yeah.
On February 28th, I'll never forget the day, I took a rock to the head and it gave me a concussion. And it didn't crack the helmet too. I have this blue Gravel helmet, and people say, look, I get so many comments on it because it's kind of like 3D or whatever.
Yeah.
But it didn't even crack the helmet.
Oh, wow.
But I did have a concussion. And it was like, man, could you imagine if that rock hit my head and I didn't have a helmet on?
Oh, yeah.
And it's like, and I wear my helmet most of the time, but now in Potrero, it's like I wear my helmet fucking all the time. So I was like literally telling you the story, and then I kicked a small rock on you. A small rock came off on when we were working on our route, Viento de Primavera, which I want to talk about that in a little bit as well. So I hit a small rock and it hit you right in the head.
Yeah.
And you're wearing your helmet.
Yeah.
And then was it the next day you took another rock to the head?
Next day.
And this one cracked your helmet.
Yeah.
And it was a Petzl helmet. It did its job.
Yeah.
What meaning do you give? I mean, this season's been crazy, but what specifically, because I'm just like, if you come to Potrero, you should be wearing a helmet. You know, it's like, I know helmets aren't generally worn everywhere. I mean, I think culturally it's like, we don't wear them in the gym. So a lot of people don't wear them sport climbing, but like Potrero, if you're coming to Potrero, you should have a fucking helmet, you know?
You should, yeah.
But what meaning do you give to those two experiences of like literally using your helmet 2 days in a row?
Yeah, just like the opportunity cost, like, of not wearing a helmet that day, that second day specifically, like that would have been really bad. Cause I was on a second pitch. My leader had taken a fall that would have knocked me out for sure.
We're talking your leader who is a lighter climber than you.
Yeah.
Pulled off a rock you had already pulled on, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Cause I had done the climb and the wall looks bulletproof compared to other
walls.
The
ripped wall.
Yes.
In the Virgin Canyon.
Yeah. It looks super solid. Yeah. So I was like, okay, yeah, like the climb is really nice. You should go for the lead. She goes for the lead and pulls off this, like it's not that big. It was like the size of a beer can, but from like 15, 20 meters up, it was so quick. Like, cause in my mind, like I thought like, okay, I'm going to blink and then try to like dodge the, like it was so quick. Like there's no time for anything. Like I didn't even like, I just saw it and it just hit my head. It jarred my teeth, like it bit my tongue. And I was like, holy shit, like that would have knocked me out. And then what? If it would have knocked me out first, like having a Grigory, like super helpful.
Right. But yeah, Grigory, that's, I had a partner actually take a fall belaying me one time in the creek. I was doing a first ascent, my good friend Tim Folks. I've written about this in The Desert, in one of my books. I was going up on a loose detached block. And so I was like, hey, Tim, crawl in that chimney over there and get out of the way in case I pull this off. He walks out and the ledge collapses on him and he falls upside down.
Oh, wow.
And a rock lands on him.
Oh.
And the Grigory catches.
Yeah.
The importance of, I think, a helmet and a auto locking device just can't be understated, you know? Yeah. Sometimes I spiritually am like, what just happened? I should have died. Like, do you give a spiritual meaning to that? Or is it you just like, I need to wear my helmet? It's an opportunity, like you said, opportunity cost.
It's more the opportunity cost. Yeah. Like it would have impacted my job because I would not have made it to the boat like back in time. Yeah, I would have, like, imagine just going to the hospital in Monterrey, like having to figure out how to go to Protección Civil. You cracked your head open.
Response time, I mean, the community here is like beautiful. The rescue team is beautiful. People will rally to assist you, but it's a slower response time here in El Potrero Chico than it is would be in like Yosemite or something like that. It's like, it really is. It's just slower, you know, and we're the nearest hospital is in Monterey, which is, it's pretty, we've been to the ER in Monterey. Like it's a long ways away. And it's, I feel like anything we can do, especially in Potrero. And I'm saying this just for people that are listening that are like, have been to here once or thinking about coming. It's like, definitely like bring a helmet to Potrero. And then also, yeah, just think about what if you are going to get hurt? What does that look like? And it's a lot slower here.
Yeah.
But that said, it's something I've noticed these last two seasons is the community here is such an amazing community. And it's like, it's so transient. Like how many local, you know, climbers like Americo, Carla,
yeah,
Michelle, like yeah. There's, and I'm missing some obviously, but it's really a transient community that also feels like we come back year after year.
Yeah.
And it's different than any other climbing area I've ever been to, Potrero.
It has its own gravitational pull.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's cool.
What keeps you coming back here year after year?
The convenience of it all, the fact that it's cheap and it's walking distance from your campground. It's so varied. Like each canyon has its own style and you can do single pitch, multi-pitch, adventurous lines, developing stuff. Yeah, it's so varied. And there's lifetimes. Like we've only barely scratched the surface here.
And then going to Culo de Gato.
Yeah.
We went to this crag, Culo de Gato, which is in the guidebook. I feel like sometimes crags get hyped and they're like, oh, this is the coolest crag ever. And I go there. I'm like, eh, you know. Mm. But Culo de Gato, when we went there, I was like, my mind is still blown and it's so close to Potrero. Like you see it in your way if you're driving to those hot springs or whatever. And it's Ventanas de Mina. Yeah. Yeah. And the rock's completely different than Potrero. So yeah. Hopefully we can develop out there. Yeah, but you're right. It's like, cool. It's lifetimes in Potrero. And then there's Culo de Gato. And then there's La Huasteca. And there's El Salto. And there's the Cumbia
La
Cave.
Popa.
La Popa.
My like, God. Never ends.
It's man. Yeah. It's such a center. It just has a, this place has a gravitational pull of, like even just flying in when I went back to the United States, back to New Jersey and back to the just New York City, you know, city's life and, you know, all that doldrums. And then flying back into Monterey and you start to see the mountains. It's just like, wow, this is, there's some gravitational pull that so many of us feel towards El Potrero Chico.
Yeah.
But I want to use the rest of our time to talk about doing new routes and also just like giving back to the climbing community. And we had both realized we both like put up new routes. So we started putting up routes. We did a route in the Surf Bowl. Yeah. Actually, we tried to bolt this thing, this like tufa weird blobby thing. And we realized
spongy.
It was the shittiest, spongiest rock that wouldn't even take a bolt. And then we moved over left and we put up Johnny Utah, which is a new 11B, which we originally rated it 10D
because
we were
of the
partying.
Boys, the boys.
Because of the 10D boys. Sorry, 10D boys. We changed the grade. I think it's 11BC.
Yeah.
That's what I'm going to give it. But that was literally like one of the first things we did together was put up this new route. And then right after we did that route, we started to put up another route in the spires, Viento de Primavera. And then we've also all season, we've replaced bolts. We fixed anchors. We've added a lot of permadraws. I remember being at Home Depot with you in Monterey one day and you're just like so giddy just to get chains. And it's just like, I was thinking about it. I was like, man, when you go to Home Depot and you get your chains, you know, ready for permadraws and anchors, you just want, like, we're so excited. And the person at Home Depot is just like doing their job and they're like, what are these climbers doing with this stuff, you know?
Yeah.
What drives you to put up new routes, to maintain old routes? It seems like that's another passion we share. And I want to hear your perspective on where that drive comes from.
So with route developing, it's cool how it's the interpretation of something that's so abstract and it's, there's an art to it that you develop in time for sure. It's a beautiful game because referencing to what I was saying earlier, the perspective in geological terms of how long this piece of rock has been up here is just so crazy to me. And like to be able to interpret it in your own way and then eventually to climb it is something that's just like almost poetic. And it's also it's something you share. It's not just for you. Like it's, hopefully you're going to create this climb that's going to be a wild experience for anyone that's willing to try it. So I think that's really cool.
And so how did it start for you in Guate? Is it like you see a line that you want to bolt and like, how does that go down?
Well, it originally started by me being scared out of my mind with this run out. And then I asked the first Ascensionist if I could place another bolt. And he said, like, oh, yeah. Yeah, like absolutely. We didn't have enough bolts at the time. But yeah, feel free to add the
bolt. A lot of roots are like not some crazy epic. They just ran out of bolts. So the first Ascensionist gives you permission for this. Yeah.
But I was super young and I didn't have the money. So I remember I had to come up with the money. And I made like this like the photo shoot for Bosch Drills back home, for like the distributor of Bosch Drills in Guatemala. I had to recruit my mom to give me a catch.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
And so they hired you to do a photo shoot? And
yeah.
That's how you got the drill?
Yeah, because I got a discount by doing the shoot.
Wow.
So I get the drill, right? I place the one bolt.
And they wanted you to do climbing?
No, like drilling, like with the drill in my harness and like holding the drill while I'm rappelling and like that sort of stuff.
And this is Bosch.
Yeah.
See, I've never heard of anything like Bosch interacting with climbers. And like, you know what I mean? It's like we use so much concrete stuff.
Yeah.
So so how did that connection go down? Did you know someone who worked for Bosch or?
I just like went to the distributor and asked them if they were interested in like, because I wanted the drill.
Yeah.
And I wanted a discount. So they're like, okay, what can you do? They ask me, and I'm like, well, there's like climbing. And I showed them pictures of the climbing spots in Guatemala.
So somewhere out there, is there like a photo of you in a Bosch advertisement?
I don't know, but I got the discount. So yeah. So anyways.
So you got a power drill.
Yeah.
Okay, that's beautiful.
I placed the one bolt, and then I started like, ooh, then what's next? Like all the possibilities. I leave the drill like the way you did in the surf bowl, where you leave the drill in the bag, like all the bolt kit in a little cave. And then
we'll give away that my drill's at the surf bowl right now. Oh. I'm just kidding. We're going to have it down by the time this airs.
Anyways, it gets stolen.
Oh,
before I get to place another bolt.
Oh.
So I just like, I got the drill, placed one bolt. That's it. End of story.
The stash got stolen.
Yeah.
That's the worst nightmare.
With my car keys.
Oh, in Felipe.
Yeah.
Oh, Felipe. Bro.
Yeah. Yeah, that sucked.
What happened then?
I had to get a locksmith. And yeah, I was not happy with myself. And all my friends were like, we told you. Like, yeah, you don't want to carry the extra weight. But like in Guatemala, it's not intelligent to leave stuff stashed. Like,
so how'd you get did you get another drill?
Yeah. I worked
save
for
up
it.
Your money.
Yeah,
and,
yeah. It took more time.
I remember back in the day, it's like I have power drills, just like a tool in the toolbox now. But I remember I was like, they were like $700 back in the day.
Oh, yeah.
And I started with a hand drill. It's like, I'll never be able to afford a power drill, you know? And now they're pretty, you can get the lightweight Milwaukee ones. Like, especially, it's weird how the price difference in Mexico is we've been at Home Depot buying chain and like sometimes weirdly things are expensive or cheap. But I feel like I got a drill here pretty reasonable. But so you're, you finally get another drill.
Yeah.
And you probably take it at home every time. Because,
for sure. But then I really scope out the lines. With that time window, it gave me time to scope out some lines and just like imagine like where some of the climbs could go and just like reinterpret the crack that had been reinterpreted by my heroes in a different way. And it's really cool to see that now like the young kids are like adding their own lines. Like these like futuristic, crazy lines. Yeah, so it's cool how history is a cyclical thing.
And then what about crag maintenance? Because I feel like crag maintenance is such a patchwork thing that we all do. And I really enjoy it. Sometimes it's like being a custodian, you know? Sometimes you're like, damn it. But I feel like for me, it's a way to give back to the community.
Yeah.
What does it mean to you?
Yeah, it's just providing a safe experience to other climbers. And when you think of like, again, like how long that rock has been up there and if you are going to put hardware that's going to deteriorate shortly after, it doesn't make any sense. Like we've all been there where we place a few bolts and like years later, you're like, holy shit, like this thing is rusted, like super rusty. So yeah, you got to bite the bullet and just like, yeah, keep the standards. Otherwise it's, it doesn't look nice. Like even if it's like full strength and whatever, it's not nice when you have like rusty hardware. And
even if it's just surface rust, because a lot of times the rusty bolts aren't necessarily the sketchy ones because it's just surface rust. That's what I learned from my buddy Timmy Tormey, who's an engineer, and you're an engineer as well. It's like sometimes rust is just on the surface. You're right. It doesn't look to the eye how you perceive it. It's like you don't ever want to look at an anchor, especially in a sport climbing area, mm-hmm. and even think about it. You know what I mean? Like yeah. with bolts, you want to feel comfortable. Yeah. And thanks for being a good partner with replacing bolts and being patient with me when I do all these shenanigans. I know people sometimes they go climbing with me. They're like, Luke's always doing some extra bullshit and you've never once complained.
It's part of it.
It is.
But I think with that, we should also like bring awareness because at least in Guatemala, there are some sinkholes that are very beautiful, but like people keep adding bolts and there are really good glue-ins, really good bolts. But if there's a new party that's trying to make their own expedition, they're going to place more bolts. And it's super sad to see. I think this also happened in El Cap and other places where you have it just like bolts everywhere. Mm-hmm. And that's like contamination in a way.
Mm-hmm. What do you mean by sinkhole? Like that's a style of the climbing areas or?
Well, because Central America is such a new continent. It's all like limestone in origin and it's also very volcanic as well. But you do get these massive sinkholes. And there's this 150-meter sinkhole called El Cimarrón. There's actually a project by Stefan Glowax to bolt a line and climb it there. Like, yeah. Like, I don't have any social media, but my friends were just, like, telling me just now, like, oh, you know who's coming to Guatemala to bolt a line and try and climb this thing? So, yeah. Like,
interesting.
Yeah, there's a lot of potential in that place.
Yeah, we do have to always kind of think about our impact and be I feel like both you and I are at this for me it's very clear that it's like we're at this age where we are kind of mentors to the younger generation and it's I feel like Potrero is really a place where you get that you really get to interact with people and people are so grateful for bolt replacement and yeah I just want to give a shout out to the American Safe Climbing Association who has given us so much hardware that we placed this year. And then also, yeah, Escalada Libre in Monterrey. Is there a group in Guate that...
No, there's none.
There's bolt replacement?
No. And
so, how do you even get bolts in Guate?
It's just out of pocket. Yeah, it's so expensive. You need to order them from Spain. So, uh-huh. Everybody pitches in with money and you mm-hmm. get a big box of, like, 100 bolts or something.
Is Guate a country, too, where, like Keith Brett was telling me in Ecuador, it's like there's a couple drills and they, like, float around. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. Uh-huh. And then that's the same with ropes and draws. Like you can't like climbing shoes. Oh my God. Like if you have a friend that's going to the States, like everybody's like, can I get some spur? I need some climbing shoes. Like, and you get that same request by all your buddies. So yeah, it's a climbing community for sure. Like just getting all the gear down there.
Yeah. And I want to just end on, this new route that we put up together called Viento de Primavera. You gave it the name. Yeah, we put up this route, Johnny, Utah, which is kind of like the surf bowl warm up now. Unless it's your project, but it's the easiest route in the surf bowl.
But it's nice.
And literally, we finished it that day. We went out partying, and like we were saying, neither one of us party much anymore. We're not drinking six beers every night. But we had a night at the El Potrero Chico Brewing. We had a night and we partied with these young Brits that are like 23 and 24 and you did some salsa dancing.
Mm-hmm.
I remember that. And we went out the next day and had a send train, a hungover send train. And then I think we finished that up and then I was like, Felipe, I showed you this new route on the Spires that we both agreed is probably the finest sport route we've been able to touch.
Yeah.
We might be biased. You never trust a route developer what they say about their routes, but we're both enamored by this line and we went and did it. Right after we finished Shawnee, Utah, we climbed up the spires, wrapped down and we wrap bolted it. Before we talk about the route, can you just tell me, Viento de Primavera is the name of a poem by a Guatemalan poet?
The poet's name is Alaide Fopa. And so you have to know that Guatemala had a civil war that lasted 26 years. It just ended in 1998 and it was brutal, super violent, horrific. Lots of these like artists, poets, writers had to leave the country or were brutally killed, like just for having the slightest like idea against the government. The poem is just like the most like harmless poem, but it was interpreted as a political thing and she was like tortured and killed. She's like a martyr now for what art can be. And yeah, it's cool to see that her poetry lives on. It's a small tribute to this like Guatemalan poet.
Oh, and what did you say her name was?
Alaide Fopa.
You said that earlier, but I was just like entranced in this story because I had no idea that there was a civil war that just ended in your lifetime.
Yeah. Wow. I was born during the Civil War.
Wow. Yeah. Wow, that's intense. And it gives more meaning to this climb. You know, I feel like picking a name, because I originally wanted to call it the Safety Dance, or that was my first idea, because with this season and how many accidents, and you have this thing called the Safety Dance.
Because I love to dance.
And you're, every time we do our check, we're just like, let's do our Safety Dance. And yeah. And you're also like, look at me. I love when people are like, let's do this safety check. Because it's like one of those things, I think I have a line, like some climbers are like careless, like they're giving it, they're like fishing and they're drunk.
Yeah.
You know, it's like fucking do the safety check and do it good. And you gave a name to that, the Safety Dance. And then you countered with Viento de Primavera. And I'm like, I'm never going to turn one. I feel like for me, it's in Pechero, it's important to either use Spanglish or Spanish or bilingual names.
Uh-huh.
And this one is Spanish, but it's also like, I'm never going to turn down an idea to name something after a poet. And then it's like, cause I'm a poet, but it's also like, and then a poet who died in for like a cause. And so this route is a tribute to this poet. And, like, I feel like we just scored on this line. It's just for people that are listening, they're familiar with Pechero. It's just the ride of Pangaea. It's in between Pangaea and,
Gondwanaland,
two great names. Mm-hmm. And I feel like we just scored. It's like my, like I in the climbing world now is like the overlooked line. And this was just that overlooked line. And I showed it to you. I thought about it for a year before we did anything.
Oh, wow.
Cause you never know. You're like in your mind, you're like, is this a squeeze job or whatever? You know, you always want to consider all the past. And the day I showed it to you, I'm like, no, it's on. Like I waited a year to go back to it. And then I showed you and you're like, oh no, this is an obvious, obvious line. And we've been working on this line for months.
Yeah.
Like we put the anchors up in October.
Yeah.
And here we are in, ironically, the spring winds, you know?
Yeah. How poetic as well.
How poetic. And this line is also the interesting thing is it's right at both of our kind of quote unquote limit.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's to me, it's been this great gift and I don't think I'm going to send it. I'm really rooting for you to send it. And I think that's like working a route. Like I had this experience with my friend Dave Marcinowski, and we worked the Queen, that thing I was mm-hmm. telling you about, and I showed you the movie. I think did I show you that
yeah.
movie?
Yeah, yeah,
that we made. But it was 4 years of working on the same climb, and there's this back and forth with a partnership. It's like with you, I'm not competitive, but you make me want to try to like reach a high point. You want mm-hmm. you make me want to try harder. And I feel like that's almost like the sport thing that is in other sports. Like you see basketball documentaries and like Steph Curry's talking about his, you know, teammates or whatever. And climbing, I don't think we give enough credit to like the teammate aspect of it. I don't know. I feel like there's this back and forth between me and you on this route. You're definitely like cranking harder than me. You're doing better than me. I really want you to succeed. I don't even care if I think I told you that too. Like this season, I'm just like, I had one send and if I don't send anything else, I'm okay with it. But what has this route and this process kind of been like for you?
Interesting, because it's not about the send. It's about the process and trying hard and just knowing that the line isn't going anywhere. So you can always come back to it. I'd like to just do it one day where it feels like a 5'10". Like how cool would that be? It's just a stepping stone. So imagine like just progressing your climbing abilities to the point where you go back to this climb and it just feels like, oh, it just flows so nicely, like a 5'10 would. But it's been really cool getting in the whole projecting mindset, but also learning that it's okay to just try hard and fail, like, and to sometimes like think about like fear of failure or like feeling like you're going to disappoint people and how it's not really the case, or just having the mental dialogue with that aspect, because it's not about always succeeding. It's about putting in the effort, trying hard. And I think that's the most valuable thing.
I couldn't agree more. And I think that on Hombre de Rifle the other day, you're like, man, I don't know. Like I love coming back to Pechero and I'm going to be a little bum when I send this and the journey's over. And I thought that was really interesting. And I think it's also like you see so many people trying a hard climb over time period. And it's so interesting to see how different people react to like sending or, but I think that perspective of just like, you're just giving the effort on the thing, that's really where the essence of it is. But I feel like there also is so much value placed on the send, like the green check mark that I was telling you about,
yeah,
the 5/6 plus shirt that we're making fun of. But I think that's a cool perspective to like end this conversation on, is like this journey that we're on is, it doesn't really end with like a climb that you do or anything. It proves how like just not meaningless, because I think we all want to have completion to our journeys and stuff, mm-hmm. but just like the meaning of climbing is like every time you're getting out doing yeah. it, you know,
it's the fact that you're struggling that gives it a lot of meaning. It's interesting, and it's ironic almost how you're pursuing the struggle. It's not about like the pat on the back and people telling you how good you are. It's about struggling. And I think that's what gives climbing its meaning.
I was having a conversation with someone who was just getting into climbing, and she was just like climbing 5.9s or something here. And she's like, yeah, there's so many people are climbing these so hard at 5.13. And I was like, honestly, 5.9 and 5.13 are kind of the same thing these days. Like, you're not hot shit if you're climbing 5.13. Mm. There's 5.15 DX, whatever, yeah. you know, like we're all kind of dabbling in mediocrity. You know yeah. what I mean? It is beautiful. It's like to come in peace with that. And it is so cool to send your hardest route at 38, at 45, at 55. There's a yeah. new journey with climbing that exists as you get older. That's really, I think, exciting. Thank you so much, Felipe. I could talk to you forever, but we'll just talk off the mics.
All right, yeah. Thank you, Luke.
All right.
All peace. Right. That was my conversation with Felipe Garcia. Just a little note, if you have your own listener love, you can record it and send it to us at luke@climbingzine.com. It could be a reflection that you've had after listening to one of those book on tape seasons or just an episode you like. And yeah, just give us a little shout out. Let us know where you're from. Yeah, the shorter and sweeter, the better. Music for this episode is by Devin Dabney. Our digital editor and producer is Chad Rich. Keep listening, because we're going to drop a little beat by Devin Dabney, one of our instrumentals from the Microdose mixtape. And we're going to finish that off there. All right. Peace.